Chapter 24. Daly and Mary were in a small room, hidden down a long corridor that led away from the large ballroom in Cursive House. She had taken him by the hand and led him through the first door she had found unlocked. They kissed passionately. Then she slid her body down his and onto her knees. His fingertips grazed her hair as she worked slowly backwards and forwards, his legs trembling as he leaned against the wall of the dark room. He looked down as a narrow beam of moonlight illuminated her auburn hair and desperately resisted the urge to pull her closer. "No. Stop," he moaned, pulling her to her feet and stroking her face.
"I don't want to,"
she whispered throatily, as she undid the button of her jeans with one hand, caressing him with the other. Instinctively, desperately, he lifted her up by the thighs and turned her so that her back was against the wall. She curled her arms around his neck and wrapped her legs around his back as he gently eased himself into her. Slowly at first, then frantically, they made love. He could feel her heart beating in her chest as their passion climaxed, then subsided. They held on to each other, breathing in time, the smell of her hair and her perfume filling his senses.
"I so, so love you, Jim Daly," she whispered, nuzzling into his neck.
His phone rang, buzzing loudly against the floor where his trousers lay. He let her down gently, then pulled them up, searching in the pocket for the mobile.
"Where are you, DCI Daly?"
He recognised Superintendent Symington's voice instantly. He also noted the urgency in her tone.
"We have to get down to the hotel. There's a car at the front door. It's D.S. Scott. He's in trouble."
Maxwell stared from one man to the other, then back to the large computer screens in front of him.
"If you think I'm going to be blackmailed in this way, you can fuck off," he said, his voice slightly slurred from the whiskey he'd drunk. "Nothing in the world will make me do this."
The large man in the dark uniform of a police officer got to his feet.
"You're not understanding the situation, Mr. Shannon. I'm here to help you," he said, his Irish accent strong. "You sound like a fucking double-glazing salesman. I'll say it again. Fuck off."
The big Irishman stepped forwards towards Maxwell, who was squirming uncomfortably on a swivel chair.
"You've spent your life thinking the world should do what you want it to, haven't you, Maxie boy?"
He lunged forwards, grabbing Maxwell's chin in his large hand and angling his head up so their faces were only inches apart.
"You can't be happy seeing your wee subsidiaries doing so badly, can you?"
"How do you... What are you talking about?"
replied Shannon, cursing his mistake.
"I would have expected better from a man like yourself, Maxie. I really would. The question is, why is it happening?" "Because you're trying to paint me into a fucking corner so that I give you control of my company. Well, it won't work. We have assets to burn. I already have a team of people working this problem. When they discover who's behind it, you'll find out what it means to be bullied."
He tried to stand, but was pushed back into his seat by the big man.
"That's where you're very wrong, Mr. Shannon. Of course, my friends would love you to give us control of your organization. Who wouldn't want their hand on the tiller of the biggest private company in the world, and everything that comes from that, eh? Aye, we had a nice plan, still have it, in fact, a plan to make you desperate to help us. But things have changed."
"In what way?"
"We're here to help you with the collapse of your associates, let's call them. In fact, we want to be your new partners. So would you not say that it's time me and you tried to work together? Because I tell you, if you don't do something quickly, there'll be no such company as Shannon International by this time next week, and you and your friends on the board will be behind bars for the biggest fraud in corporate history. How does that sit with you, Mr. Shannon?"
Maxwell's face lost all colour as he sat back in the chair. He looked at the Irishman, his companions, then the huddle on the floor that was the family caretaker, Percy.
"Is he dead?"
"No, he's not dead. Just having a nap, so he is."
"Pity. He's an irascible old bastard.
He used to boot me in the arse when I was a boy. Do us all a favour and make him disappear. Then we'll talk.
The big man smiled at his captive.
You're a real charmer, eh? Kill an old man because he kicked you in the backside when you were a sprog, a boot you no doubt deserved. Well, this is one wish that won't come true for you, Maxwell. That old man seems to have friends in very unexpected places.
Without warning, he swung his fist and caught Maxwell squarely on the jaw.
That's for having no respect for your elders. And in any event, you've no idea how long I've wanted to do that to you.
Now, you get cleaned up and get back to your party. And remember, one word to the boys in blue, and you'll be taken in the next New Year, and many, many thereafter, behind bars, my friend.
And what will I say to the rest of the board, to my senior execs? I take it you have Lars Bergner. Oh, I'm sure you'll think of something to say to those good old boys. That's your strong suit, talking, cajoling, making folk do things they don't really want to. And no, we have as little idea where Mr. Bergner is as you do. Nor are we responsible for everything else that's happened in this village over the last wee while. It would appear that you've got enemies coming out of the woodwork. Trust no one, Maxie. Do you get me?
So I just do what you tell me to. I'm at a disadvantage here, but believe me, I'll make sure you and whoever is behind this pays.
You believe just what you want, Maxie. But I'll tell you this. With the help of my friends, you can be one of the richest men in the world in your own right. No waiting for your old father to peg out, or your hatchet-faced auntie to give you the thumbs up before you can make a move. We're going to move you along a bit more smartly. I think it looks as though we're the only friends you have.
As the police car drove into the village, Daly could see flames leaping from the large bonfire in the field behind the hotel. People milled about, some being comforted by their fellow villagers. His chest was tight, that familiar feeling, like an old friend, or perhaps his worst enemy. All was there when those close to him were in peril. The car skidded to a halt in the car park of the Black Wherry Inn. He jumped from the vehicle and raced towards the dancing flames of the bonfire, forcing his way through the crowd of people, many of them looking tearful and stunned. His heart lurched in his chest as he walked towards the smouldering remains of a man lying on the ground, covered by a singed overcoat. The weight at his core was impossible to resist as he sank to his knees on the hard snow.
"I'm sorry," said Jessie, putting her hand on his shoulder. "We called you as soon as we could. Tried to get the fire out, but we couldn't get enough water onto it. Turned out there was a big hole in our hose."
"What? I mean, how did this happen? Couldn't someone have tried to pull him down, tried anything?"
"We'd put too much petrol onto the wood. Wherever that stray spark came from, a kid's sparkler or whatever, the whole thing just went up. Boom!"
She raised her hands to emphasise the event.
"If it's any comfort, we know he didn't suffer, the poor bugger."
"How on earth do you know that?" asked Daly,
looking blankly at the smouldering remains under the old overcoat.
"By all accounts, he was in some state before the fire caught. He was well out of it before he started to burn. Probably dead. A blessing, poor man."
Daly looked again at the corpse, a mound under a heap of singed rags. Again the cruel nature of fate clawed at him. The stench of burning flesh was strong. He wrinkled his nose.
"How did he manage to get into such a state? I only saw him a few hours ago."
"Oh, I didn't know that," said Jessie, looking surprised. "Well, he was sitting at the top of the bonfire with John McEachran's old boiler suit on and his head in a Hessian bag the last time I saw him."
"He was what?"
Daly stared at the woman in disbelief.
"Why wasn't I told about this? I was up at Kersevay House when all this was going on."
Daly turned to the woman, his eyes flashing with anger.
"This isn't just anyone, though for anyone to have died like this would have been a tragedy. What the
fuck is wrong with you all?"
Daly was breathing heavily, the world spinning before him. Superintendent Symington reached out to place her hand on his shoulder. Behind them, people moved aside to let a man with a blackened face, shoulders covered by an old blanket, through to where the corpse lay.
"I know a pretty sight, right enough," he said,
before starting to cough. Daly turned to face him, then jumped to his feet, eyes wide in disbelief. His mouth was moving, but no sound came out. Symington, standing at his side, decided to break the silence.
"I had a call to say that D.S. Scott had been set alight on a bonfire, and to get here as quickly as possible. My colleague," she said, nodding to Daly, "obviously came to the same conclusion as me."
"Oh, right," said Jessie. "Och, it was one of the boys in the hotel that called you. Chinese whispers in this bloody place. But right enough, he was up on the bonfire when it went up, but Big Mecky Deans pulled him doon. The pair of them jumped clean through the flames. We couldna get this poor soul doon, mind you. Had to wait until Archie got here wi' his earth mover, and we kind of scooped him off the top and doused him wi' water."
"You thought it was me under that coat," said Scott. "Nay wonder you looked like you seen a ghost."
Despite the obvious tragedy, Scott stifled a laugh.
"Since this clearly isn't the last mortal remains of D.S. Scott, just who is it?" asked Symington.
"I think I know the answer to that, Superintendent," replied a well-spoken man. "He was pretty mangled when I saw him before the fire. Looked as though he'd been hit by a train, but I'd swear that the man lying there is Lars Bergner," said Bruce. Chapter 25. Moore looked down at his wife as she slept on the couch by the roaring fire. He stroked his chin and sighed, reaching once more for the phone in front of him. He had covered her with a blanket, and now stared deep in thought as her long dark lashes flitted in the light of the flames. The whiskey he was drinking was straight, the undiluted spirit stinging his throat as he gulped another mouthful. "Why did I agree to this?" he thought, as he passed his hand through his greying hair, tugging at it in desperation. "You fucking fool," he whispered under his breath. He answered the phone almost as it rang, anxious not to wake her, but even more concerned to speak to the caller. "Are you alone?" the man on the other end had asked in a low voice. "Yes. Well, my wife is here, but she's asleep." "Listen very carefully. The situation has changed. You will have to do what we talked about."
"But how? The place is crawling with police now. The whole village is."
"The cops are stretched. They can't get more manpower to the area because of the weather. We've taken a few extra steps to keep them off our back, and it's about to snow again."
"Shit, mate. So me and the guys are stuck here with no way out?"
"Come on, that's not the kind of stuff I expect from a man of the cloth. There's always a way out. Trust me."
"Yeah, sure, but maybe not the way I want to go."
"Relax, Reverend Moore. Take another few glasses of whiskey, but be ready for a call tomorrow. We can do this, but you've got to play your part." The call ended.
"Shit," snapped Moore, making
his wife stir again in her sleep. He put down the phone, picked up his glass, and walked over to her.
"I'm doing this for us, honey,"
he said quietly, stroking her hair. The whiskey burned his throat as he drained the glass. Scott was in the passenger seat of a police Land Rover, Pollock at the wheel. Daly had demanded he go for a check-up at the hospital in Kinloch after his brush with incineration. He was deep in thought as he stared through the window, watching large flakes of snow settling on the glass, only to be brushed away by the windscreen wipers. The brief euphoria of being rescued from the flames of the Blan bonfire had receded rapidly when the old coat had been removed from the charred body that Daly had thought was him. It had been surreal watching his friend begin the process of mourning his death. Humorous, even. But then, as the adrenaline and whiskey in his system had started to fade, the cold reality dawned that, one day, the man burned to a cinder or shot dead on the beach would indeed be him.
"Penny for them," said Pollock. "Ach,
ever get the feeling that it was time you moved on. How long have you been in this job? About the same as me, likely.
Aye, I would say so. Not long till we both get to retire, though. If we make it, that is, replied Scott with a shake of his head.
I'm surprised. Everybody tells me that you're the joker in the pack. You're no sounding too funny the night, Brian.
Scott gazed out into the darkness.
Some days it just doesn't seem right to be laughing.
They drove past tall banks of snow forced to the side of the road by the snowploughs. The Land Rover skidded slightly on the slick road. Snow, then ice, then more snow. It was a lethal combination. Pollock managed to keep the vehicle on the road, slowing down even further.
Bugger! We'd be able to walk quicker. The bloody road's in some state. If this is going to be another heavy fall, I can't see them being able to keep it open, said Pollock. Don't say that. If we can't get to and from Bland by road, the bastards will have me aboard a boat before you know it.
He sighed deeply and fished in his pocket.
Mind if I have a fag? I hope you're no one of these delicate flowers like the lads that brought me here earlier. You'd have thought I'd asked if I could piss out his heat when I went to light up.
As long as you gie me one as well, we'll be fine.
Good man, said Scott.
Once the cigarettes were lit, and sweet blue tobacco smoke filled the cab.
How long have you been on the rural patrol down here, Willie?
Just a month or 15 years. To be honest, I wouldn't be anywhere else. When I'm out here in the Land Rover, I'm away for any trouble with the boys in Braid, if you know what I mean.
Ah, you can bet your bottom dollar I know what you mean, replied Scott.
What the fuck's going on in Blan? I've never seen the like.
Well, to put it in perspective, do you know how many arrests I made last year?
Tell me.
4, said Pollock. Aye, and that includes the same man twice for being drunk and incapable. They wanted to gie me a service promotion to sergeant and stick me in the office at Kinloch. Why would you want that?
I hear you, pal, I hear you. How far to go?
Another 5 miles. We're just about halfway there,
replied Pollock, peering into the gloom.
Daly felt Superintendent Symington's gaze on him as he and Dunn took statements at the Black Wherry Inn. He wondered if she guessed what he and his young D.C. had been up to before the dash to rescue Scott. As the last villager left, the police officer sat at a table with a large pot of steaming coffee. Jesse and Annie busied themselves cleaning tables, washing down the bar and polishing glasses. At another table sat Jock Monroe, savouring the last few mouthfuls of his whisky. It was after 4 in the morning, and Daly's eyelids felt heavy. He sipped the strong coffee and hoped it would get to work quickly.
"There's something here that doesn't make sense," said Symington, breaking the silence. "We must consider this to be a sustained campaign against the Shannon family, planned well in advance and being executed by professionals. But they couldn't have known how the weather would behave with this snow. Under normal circumstances, at the first sign of danger, the Shannon party would just have shipped out en masse. There's no way anyone could have planned for them being marooned here."
"Maxwell Shannon has no intentions of leaving, regardless of the circumstances," said Daly.
"Not even if we discover that charred corpse is Lars Bergner?"
"He says the family won't be intimidated, adamant that they're staying put until they get this AGM over at least."
"Well, DCI Daly, he can be as adamant as he likes. If a weather window opens up long enough to get them out of here they'll bloody well go,"
she exclaimed, her voice raised. Looking at her steely expression, Daly had no doubt about her determination. Here was somebody who was used to having an opinion and getting her own way, he thought.
"They've been the same down the generations," boomed Jock Monroe, standing and zipping up his jacket. "Sorry, I couldn't help hearing what you said, madam. The Shannon family are stubborn bastards. Aye, and now they're collectively as rich as Croesus. There's not much can be done to gainsay them."
"Well, we'll see. We don't have to be billionaires to change the course of events."
"In any case," said Jock, "I don't think you're about to get your weather window."
"Not good," said Daly. I think we're stuck with the Shannons for the duration, ma'am.
I meant to say this to your Sergeant Scott, said Jock, leaning his large hand on the back of D.C. Dunn's chair. I was up at Breachery Glen early yesterday. Would you believe there's someone camping up there?
What, in this weather? Asked Dunn.
Aye, my thoughts exactly, my dear, said Jock. They didn't see me, but I saw them. A man, well built. Purposeful, if you know what I mean.
Purposeful? Asked Daly.
Och, maybe I've spent too long being a writer, observing the way people behave. I dare say you've done a fair bit of that in your time, Mr. Daly. Like poor Robert Louis Stevenson when he was a boy, confined to his bed for days on end with asthma. He could tell who was who and what they were up to by the sound of their footsteps. The steps fell light and oddly, with a certain swing. He was a fine, fine writer. But these steps weren't light at all. This man meant business.
And who would have business in a tent in Blan in the middle of a snowstorm? Said Daly.
They were about 2 miles outside Kinloch now, their progress slower still. The snow was falling so heavily now that Pollock was forced to turn the windscreen wipers to their highest speed. He leaned forwards as he carefully edged the Land Rover along.
"This road will be closed again within the hour if they don't get the ploughs out soon," he said to Scott,
who was nervously smoking his third cigarette of the journey.
"Are we going to make it, Wally? I don't fancy getting snowed up in this jalopy." "Aye, we'll make it. But if we'd left a few minutes later than we did, we'd have had no chance. We're on the home stretch now."
Scott wound down the passenger window slightly, and cursed as a flurry of cold snow hit him in the face while he was trying to dispose of his cigarette butt. As he wound it closed, he suddenly felt his chest tighten.
"You okay?"
asked Pollock.
"Aye, fine," said Scott, feeling anything but.
He stared through the windscreen, willing the journey to come to an end. It was low and soft, but the whine in his ears was unmistakable. He tried to grit his teeth against the sound, but it grew in intensity as he began to struggle for breath. It was then he saw the grey figure in the road ahead, standing stock still in the heavy snow, illuminated by the headlights. Now gasping for breath, he lurched forwards and grabbed the steering wheel, pulling it out of Pollock's grasp. The Land Rover sloughed one way then the other, jolting Scott's chest painfully against his seatbelt. Brakes squealed and Pollock yelled. Then, for a few heartbeats, everything was quiet. It was as though they were flying. The whine in his ears was replaced by the beating of his own heart. The world was in slow motion, until Pollock screamed again, and they came to a stop with a sickening thud and jolt. Chapter 26. As Daly, Symington, and Dunn walked back through the large front door of Cursivay House, they were greeted by Aitchison, the inspector in charge of the armed support unit officers who were guarding the perimeter of the mansion. His pale face and worried expression were enough to set off the alarm bells in Daly's head.
"What's up, D.I. Aitchison?" "One of my men, Constable Booth, is missing. He missed our last rendezvous and he isn't answering his radio."
"When did you discover this, Inspector?" said Symington.
"About an hour ago. We checked in with him by radio at 2. The reception was poor, but he sounded okay. But now I'm beginning to wonder if that was him at all."
Daly hurriedly arranged a search of the building and grounds. He called Glasgow in search of assistance, but the weather there was even worse than in Blan, and he was left in no doubt that the officers he had were the only ones he would see until the snow had abated. His superior in Glasgow promised to send the police helicopter as soon as it became available. However, it had been grounded for the last few hours because of the weather, and looked likely to remain so.
"I think we all need to draw weapons, DCI Daly," said Symington. "I don't want to spread alarm amongst the lads, but up until now, anyone who's gone missing has turned up dead. If the man on the bonfire proves to be Bergner, that is."
"I agree,"
replied Daly. "We're rapidly getting out of our depth here, ma'am. I'll get hold of Brian. He'll be back in Kinloch, and have been checked out in the hospital by now. I'll have him round up as many men as we can spare, and bring them here with firearms."
Daly called the office in Kinloch, only to be told that Scott and Pollock had yet to arrive. He asked the desk sergeant to contact Kinloch Hospital and have Scott call him as soon as possible. "Don't tell me there's actually something wrong with him," he thought, then worried that his friend might have already sunk into a bottle of whisky. It was after 6, but there was still no sign of morning in the dark sky, laden with snow clouds that were now discharging themselves over Blan and the rest of the country. He watched Dunn, who was busy studying footage from Kersevay House's CCTV system. She looked so young and beautiful that he felt stricken with guilt that he was about to ruin her life. In his heart, he now knew his marriage was over, had been over for a long time, if he was honest with himself. But how long could he keep hold of a woman so much younger than himself? How long would it take before the person she saw before her turned into an old man? "How are you doing with that?" he asked.
"Not that well, sir," she replied thinly.
"There are only 3 cameras, one on the bottom gate, one on the drive, and the other covering the front of the house. I haven't come across anything unusual yet."
"Keep trying." He was cut short by his mobile ringing in the pocket of his thick ski jacket. "Daly, yes? Have you located him?"
He listened for a few moments, a look of concern spreading across his face.
"I want you to send out somebody in a 4-wheel drive to have a look. They left here nearly 3 hours ago."
He ended the call and looked up at Dunn.
"Trouble, sir?" "Brian and Pollock haven't arrived back in Kinloch. Well, if they have, they're certainly not where they should be."
Quietly, he cursed the lack of faith he now had in his DS, his friend. Then he remembered Brocky's eye sockets, the disgusting mutilation of his colleague Colin Grant, and the smouldering body lying in the snow. When Scott came to, he was cold, very cold. He couldn't see anything in the darkness, apart from a red warning light on the dashboard of the Land Rover. The vehicle had landed on its side, and his head was hard against the passenger window. He could feel the cold of the snow through the glass.
"Willie! Willie!"
he shouted, reaching up towards the driver's side of the car for his colleague. The seat was empty. He struggled to take off his seatbelt, then, with great difficulty, managed to wrestle his mobile phone from the inside pocket of his jacket. He pressed buttons in the darkness until the screen illuminated. He swore loudly when he noticed that he had no signal, and in any case his battery was about to fail. Scott had often heard Jim Daly ruminate upon how his life would end. While Daly was thoughtful, often morose, in fact, Scott tried to avoid the close analysis of life and its inevitable finality. However, after being shot in 2 separate incidents involving his job, he often imagined the dark, cold hand of fate hovering above his head. He always pictured his father's face, silhouetted by the white linen of the pillow, as cancer drained his life away. His mother gasping for breath as that very same disease slowly choked her to death. He struggled up to the driver's door, now above his head.
"I don't want to die,"
he pleaded, reaching out in the darkness. The Reverend Moore sat in his kitchen and prayed. He was almost sure that what he was about to do was the right thing, but he still had nagging doubts. People like the Shannons were a cancer that fed on those who worked and struggled hard just to keep bread on the table and a roof over their heads. What did he owe them? He reached for the bottle of whiskey on the large kitchen table, then thought the better of it. His head was already swimming, and he needed to be ready to act quickly if called upon in a few hours. Tired, he rubbed his forehead with his hand as he took deep breaths. The doctor, from a private practice far from Blan, had said his wife's episodes should improve as the prescribed medication took hold. Moore wasn't convinced. If anything, they seemed to be getting worse. Not long after he'd first met the former nun, he'd been astonished to find her in his bed, dressed in only a pair of black stockings and suspenders, her face made up gaudily with bright red lip gloss and dark eyeshadow.
At first this aroused him, but soon he realized that the woman before him bore no resemblance to the person he had met, like someone under the influence of strong drugs or alcohol. He had talked to her quietly, and soon she'd slept. In the morning, when she was shocked to find herself dressed in such a manner, he knew she had a problem. Her stories of how her fellow nuns had tormented her fell into place. Either her behaviour had been so extreme they were forced to let her go, or her problems had been magnified at the hands of the order. Despite his better judgment, he reached again for the bottle and poured a large measure of whiskey into the small crystal glass. Through the crack in the kitchen door, Veronica watched her husband, silently. Daly was in a Land Rover with the old farmer, Charlie Murray, and a uniformed cop. Symington was coordinating the search for the missing member of the support unit, but he had to try and find Scott. They had travelled no more than a mile when Murray slowed the old vehicle to a stop.
"We have to turn round, Mr. Daly. We've no choice."
The snow piled against the windscreen, making the wipers whine in protest as they struggled to clear it.
"They might be able to get a snowplough in from Kinloch, but there's no way we're getting through this. If we try, I will be as marooned as your sergeant lately is."
Daly stared at the huge flakes as they sprang out of the darkness.
"Yes, you're right," he said, the regret in his voice plain.
"We'd better turn back, Mr. Murray. Thank you for trying." "The worst fall of snow we've had here since 63. I was a young man then, but it was like living through a white hell. We lost so many sheep. Aye, and folk, tay. Arthur Lays from Ballybeg Farm went out to rescue some tup, and we didn't find him until it thawed about 2 weeks later. Aye, a terrible thing, the snow. I could gie these stupid bastards that call it pretty a good kick up the arse," he said, struggling with the steering wheel as he turned the Land Rover back towards Blan. "Still, to die in the cold is the kindest death of all, they say. Ach, you just sleep away. No a bad way to go, if you ask me. Honestly, Charlie, you aren't helping. I'd gamble my dear wife on the fact your man will be just fine. He's likely sitting in some steading with a bumper dram, waiting for the boys to arrive for Kinloch with a snowplough." "I wish I shared your optimism," said Daly. "I really do."
As Scott struggled to pull himself up, he was surprised to find that the driver's door was partially open.
"Wally, are you there?"
He managed to lever himself up from his seat to grab the steering wheel, pushing with his other arm against the heavy door. A flurry of snow hit him at almost the same time as he was dazzled by a bright light shining directly into his face.
"What the fuck?"
he shouted, as strong arms lifted him clear of the stricken vehicle and out into the cold. Chapter 27 Daly was still fretting about Scott's whereabouts as he joined other officers in search of the missing Constable Booth from the support unit. The hunt took them all over Cursivay House, which was larger and even more luxurious than he had first imagined. As he stared from a window in the rear of the house, a thin pale line against the horizon marked the dawn of the first day of the new year. To his left, he saw the long modern building that was the new accommodation block, built to contain the overflow of the Shannon International AGM. Across a narrow strip of land, where a rough pathway had been dug through the snow, sat two further buildings, at right angles to each other. One of them had clearly been modernised, while the smaller construction looked old, most probably in its original form. Taken together, they looked out of place with the rest of the house. Daly heard someone walking towards him, and turned to see Nadia Shannon, dressed in a thick jumper and jeans, her blood-red lipstick in contrast with her pale face. He wondered just how the girl was coping with the events of the previous night.
"Hello, Mr. Daly," she said quietly. "I hear you have a missing police officer."
"Yes, we're searching for him now.
What are those two buildings?"
"Oh, the small cottages where Percy and his wife live. Next to it is the office and communications building. It used to be a stable, but Maxwell had it converted a few years ago. All very high-tech, apparently."
"Thanks," he said, smiling at the dark-haired girl. "We'll get down there and tick them off our list."
"I'm sorry about my family, Chief Inspector. It seems that everywhere we go, misery and tragedy follow. I've not been able to sleep. I rarely can when we're here.
You don't like Kersebay House?
I hate it. I can't think of anyone who likes being imprisoned here every year, not even Maxwell. Perhaps my grandmother, but that's all.
Yes, she mentioned that she liked it here. Maybe it's easier for an older person to enjoy being in a place like this, rather than someone your age.
My family would turn the nicest place in the world into somewhere I didn't want to be, she said. Good luck finding your colleague. I had better report back before they send out a search party for me.
He watched her wend her way back along the long passageway. A young woman with the world on her shoulders, he thought. He made his way wearily down the stairs. He had to find Inspector Aitchison and search those outbuildings. Scott shivered, watching the thin line of dull light spread through the sky over Kinloch. He was standing in the yard of a farmhouse, knee-deep in snow, smoking a cigarette. He heard the back door open and watched as Constable Pollock waded his way towards him, an impromptu bandage wrapped around his head, covering the cut he'd sustained when their Land Rover left the road.
"The landline's down, and there's no mobile signal unless we scale that hill over there, according to Mr. Moyes. I'm afraid I don't have my crampons with me, so we'll just have to keep our eyes on the road and hope that the snowplough is trying to get through."
"Listen, Willie," said Scott, shuffling his feet in the snow. "I'm sorry, I just thought I saw someone in the road, do you know what I mean?"
Pollock thrust his bottom lip out and sighed.
"Jesse told me that you had some kind of fit at the bonfire. Aye, and one of the boys told me he found you lying in the snow fair ranting when the road was blocked. I slipped, man. And as far as the Black Wherry is concerned, I just fell over with a drink. An old cop I used to work with once gave me advice I've never forgotten. Aye. He told me never to be afraid to shout for help, no matter what the situation was."
He looked Scott straight in the eye.
"I've seen good men go down to the bevy, Brian. Don't be one of them. There's nothing to be ashamed of. If you're at the stage where you're seeing stuff, well, you need help, my friend."
"Listen, thanks for pulling me out of that Land Rover and getting us here. And, as I says, I'm sorry for, well, the accident, but do me a favour. Don't listen to any gossip about me, Willie. The only thing I can see right now is a warm bed, aye, with me in it."
"As you wish, Sergeant Scott. As you wish. I'll put our wee skid off the road down to the conditions, so there'll be no repercussions, you can trust me on that. And remember, if you need to talk about anything, I've a listening ear."
And with that, Pollock turned and trudged back through the snow towards the farmhouse. Daly stood at the door of the communications office with two armed members of the support unit, Inspector Aitchison, and a worried but irritable Maxwell Shannon.
"I don't know why you need to see in here. The place is locked up and has been since the early hours of this morning. I turned the lock myself, and I can assure you that there were no missing police officers to be seen," said Maxwell, glaring at Daly.
"We have to make sure this location is as secure as it can be, Mr. Shannon. I don't have time to argue with you about this. Unlock the door, or I'll instruct my men to force it open." Reluctantly, Maxwell fumbled with a bunch of keys, selecting one and opening the heavy door. He flicked on a switch and stood, wide-eyed for a few heartbeats.
"You look surprised," said Daly, studying the businessman carefully.
Maxwell had now composed himself, but the detective had seen the bewildered expression on his face as the panel lighting hummed and flickered to life, illuminating the large room. Daly looked around. The space was not unlike a modern CID room, all large screens and computer keyboards, with a projector screen at the far end of the room. Expensive paintings, polished wood floorboards, and deep, comfortable chairs, however, marked it out as something altogether more luxurious.
"Not at all, just stunned to be back in here at this hour. I have a very important meeting this afternoon. I had hoped to get some sleep, not chase about after police officers in places they couldn't possibly be."
"What happened to your chin?"
"I was playing with the children last night, got caught with a toy truck, if you must know."
"Nasty colour," observed Daly, certain that Maxwell was lying.
He walked around the room, moving from desk to desk, studying the large bank of screens.
"So this is where you run the company from when you're here?"
"Yes. Nowadays a business can be run from just about anywhere in the world. Not my first choice of HQ, mind you."
"You were the last in here, then?"
"Yes, switched off the lights and hoped to go and get some sleep, as I said."
"Muddy boots, I see," said Daly, looking at the dirty marks on the floor. "With all this snow and slush about, is that a surprise?"
Daly sniffed the air.
"Someone's been smoking in here, too. You're not a smoker, are you, Mr. Shannon?"
"No, just the occasional cigar. I had one earlier to celebrate the new year."
Daly bent down and lifted something from the floor, tucked behind the corner of one of the large desks.
"But you don't smoke these," he said, holding up a cigarette butt.
Maxwell shook his head, shrugging off the question. Daly moved closer to the company boss, looming over him.
"If I discover that you know something about what's been happening here, and you haven't seen fit to pass this information on to me, all the money in the world won't save you."
"Interesting, Mr. Daly," Maxwell replied with a sneer. "What could you possibly do to me as a retired police officer, washed up, overweight, and unemployed? Your job is to catch whoever is perpetrating these awful crimes against my family. By placing the focus of your investigation on me, you are giving the real culprits a free hand, a mistake that I will be informing your chief constable of as soon as I can raise him today."
With that, Maxwell walked out of the room.
"I want somebody following him, subtly, from now on," said Daly to Aitchison. "I'm going to head up the glen and check out whatever it is that Jock Monroe's seen."
He took one last look around the room before leaving, catching sight of a mark low down on the wall beside the door. He kneeled down to take a closer look.
"Blood, wouldn't you say, Inspector?"
Chapter 28 Scott was lying in a private room in Kinloch Hospital, having been delivered back to town, with P.C. Pollock, by a snowplough. Though a paramedic had examined him, the busy nursing sister wanted him checked over by a doctor prior to his being discharged. He had dozed, but this fitful sleep had been populated by bad dreams, the face of the boy haunting him. As he stared at the ceiling, he wondered whether or not this was the time to confess to the hallucinations and his struggle with alcohol. Time to end the hell he was going through and get help with the problem before it consumed him wholly. But then what would he do with the rest of his life? Would this new, shiny police force want anything to do with a foot soldier who was capable of putting his own and other people's lives at risk? He wasn't like Jim Daly. He wasn't willing to abandon the only career he'd ever had just because he liked a drink or two too many. He'd known a battalion of police officers in his time who had fought similar battles with booze and won, surviving to spend happy days in retirement in Spain on a pension provided by a grateful nation. Mind you, he'd known many others who had succumbed, their reward a hospital bed to lie in and wait as their livers faltered, then failed, in tandem with the death of their brain cells. He didn't need to put his future in jeopardy just because he was experiencing this temporary crisis in his life. "Ride out the storm," his father had told him years before. "Hang on until the wind changed. It always did." The phone on his bedside table rang, and he answered without checking who the caller was.
"Brian, where the hell have you been?" Daly's voice was loud in his ear. "Stuck in a snowdrift, Jimmy. Me and Willie Pollock put the Land Rover off the road. Aye, lucky to walk out of it," he said,
hoping that his colleague would stick to his promise and put the accident down to the weather conditions.
"Where are you? I called the station and they said you were going to the hospital." "I'm here now, waiting for a doctor to give me the all clear. I was having a wee doss when you phoned, Jim,"
he lied, hoping Daly wouldn't question him about his insobriety the previous evening.
"One of the SU guys is missing, and I'm sure Maxwell Shannon has an idea what's going on. He knows something, anyway. We're just heading up to have a look at some kind of encampment old Jock Monroe spotted up the glen."
"Well, you be careful, Jim. I tell you, I can't see how they'll manage to clear that road any time soon, even with a whole army of snowploughs. We were lucky they got as far as us, and that was just a mile or two outside Kinloch. We've got a few bodies here, so we should be okay.
When they give you the all clear, I want you to dig up John Campbell. You know the lawyer from the lifeboat? He has information from years back about the history of the Shannons. I'd like you to get your hands on it as soon as.
Will do, said Scott.
But Daly had already ended the call.
Oh, I'm feeling fine. How are you? He muttered to himself,
as a youthful doctor, accompanied by an equally young nurse, knocked on the door and entered the room.
Now, Sergeant Scott, I hear you've been in the wars. Nearly went up in flames, then in a car crash, I believe.
Aye, happy New Year, son. If it carries on like this, I'll no make February.
He winced as the doctor placed a cold stethoscope on his bare chest, asking him to breathe deeply.
Now, since these incidents, have you experienced anything odd? Confusion, feeling that all's not well? You know what I mean?
No, son, nothing like that. I've got too much in my plate to have time to get confused. And as for feeling that all is not well, I've been experiencing that since the day I joined the police.
Today was not the day that Brian Scott would introduce his demons to the world. Bruce sat at the traditional early breakfast, taking in the scene at Kersevay House. There was no sign of Lars Bergner's wife or children. They were still waiting for the body pulled from the bonfire at the Black Wherry to be formally identified. His mother was there, and his daughter, Mrs. Watkins, in tow to keep her on an even keel. A host of nieces, nephews, cousins, aunts and uncles, plus lawyers, accountants, and the senior executives of the company all orbited around the main power bases, namely Ailsa Shannon and her nephew, Maxwell, locked in the struggle for control of the company. As was tradition, breakfast would begin with a few words and a prayer. This was normally conducted by the company chaplain, but he had recently retired, so the Reverend Ignatius Moore had been tasked with the job. He was looking nervously about the large ballroom, stripped down after the festivities by a team of hired help from the village. Ailsa stood up from her seat and moved round the table towards Bruce, who steeled himself for yet another dressing down. He was surprised when she held his hand and looked worriedly into his eyes.
"Mum, what's wrong?"
"Oh, Maxwell has just told me that Percy is unwell, confined to his bed, apparently. He seemed fine when I talked to him last night. I wouldn't spend too long worrying about Percy. He's as tough as old boots. More likely, he had too much whiskey last night and needs to sleep it off. He still tries to drink like a 20-year-old. Daft old bugger." "You're probably right, Bruce. I'll pay him a visit once this little charade is over."
It was Bruce's turn to look concerned. He had heard nothing from Trenton Casely, and feared that his attempt to wrest power from Maxwell would come to nothing, despite his plotting. As though she had read his mind, his mother caught him by the sleeve of his jacket and leaned in closer.
"You must promise me that you'll let events here take their own course, Bruce. This isn't the time for you to tilt at another windmill. I want you to have a word with Charles. He may want your help when it comes to voting."
"He's a good guy, Mum, but don't you think we'd be in a better position now if he had any real influence over Maxie?"
"Maxwell is greatly disadvantaged by Lars Bergner's absence. An awful situation, but it has worked to our advantage."
"Why is Maxwell going ahead? I mean, Lars' disappearance is the perfect excuse to postpone. Aren't you concerned?"
"We'll see," replied his mother, regaining some of her poise. "Maxwell thinks that it's just a matter of time until his father dies, so we should all tread water and watch the rise of the new regime. He's very confident."
There was something about the look on her face that troubled Bruce. In fact, she was more serene than he had seen her for years. She and her brother-in-law had navigated a steady, if unspectacular, path to greater success, based on the foundations laid by her late husband. But since her nephew had inherited his position, a silent battle had raged. Maxwell plotted and schemed, waiting for the day his father would die and the real power would be his and his alone. At the moment, he ran the company as a weakened regent, with Ailsa, supported by other family members, able to veto plans as they chose. The pall of young Archie's disappearance hung even more heavily over proceedings. When his father died, Archie should have been the one to take over the reins of the organisation, not his uncle, and Maxwell would have been reduced to the same powerless position Bruce now so reluctantly occupied.
"As long as we have our 50-50 veto, nothing can happen that will ruin us, Mum. We'll just have to settle for that," he said, smiling at her.
She didn't reply, but he followed her eyeline to where Brady was sitting across the table. A strange look passed across Ailsa's face. Daly knocked on the door of Percy Williamson's cottage. He could see a candle flickering in the window, almost obscured by thick snow on the sill. He shivered in the thin morning light. Then the door opened a crack, revealing the old man's face.
"Mr. Williamson, just checking that everything is okay." "Yes, good morning, Chief Inspector. Don't come too close. My wife and I have an awful bug. We've both been very sick over the last few hours. Nasty germ. I was wondering if you'd noticed anything unusual across at the office block." "What do you mean, unusual?" "You know, lots of comings and goings, people you don't know and so on. I stopped recognizing who was coming about this place more than 20 years ago. There are so many of them now, how could anyone keep track? I'm sorry, I can't be more helpful."
"Do you need anything?"
"No, no, you're very kind. We'll battle on here. Never died a winter yet, Mr. Daly. Mrs. Shannon is very kind. I'm sure she'll see to any needs we have."
Percy stared at Daly, then tossed his head to one side. A nervous twitch, Daly thought. His pallor was grey, his cheeks hollowed.
"If you don't mind, I have to go. Call of nature. Please excuse me."
He slammed the door shut. Daly could hear him hurrying along the hall, no doubt to the toilet.
"Doesn't look well, sir," observed Aitchison.
"Hope it's not one of these winter bugs that will floor us all. Last thing we need stranded here." Daly hesitated for a moment.
"Better get up the glen and see what we can find. It's light enough now."
There was something about the old caretaker's demeanour that troubled him. He filed the thought away, resolving to talk to Ailsa about it at the first opportunity. Chapter 29 Scott stamped his feet to keep warm as he stood in front of the solicitor's office in Kinloch, waiting for John Campbell to arrive. The town's main street was barely recognisable under the largest accumulation of snow anyone could remember. Hard-working council staff had managed to dig a pathway up the street, so cars, in single file, could navigate their way through the town. He watched as an expensive 4x4 made steady progress up the hill, stopping outside the gates to the office. It was an old building, just down the road from Kinloch Police Office and across from the Sheriff Court, in the heart of the town's legal quarter, as Daly put it.
"Morning, dear Scott," said John Campbell, easing his large frame from the passenger seat. "Thought it wise to have my good lady take the wheel this morning. She doesn't drink, and I'm afraid I rather made up for our shortfall in consumption last night."
He waded through the deep snow and shook the detective's hand.
"Did you have a decent hogman, eh? Probably on duty, so on the bloody wagon, eh?" "Something like that, Mr. Campbell," said Scott. "I can't say I wouldn't rather be in my scratcher, mark you. Don't worry, we'll get inside and grab a cup of coffee before I dig out old Drysdale's files. Years since I last looked at them, but very interesting, as I recall. We wanted to archive them at the local museum, but the Shannons would have none of it. Blast the snow," he added, as he struggled to push open the front door of the office. "I've never seen the like, not here at any rate. Only a matter of time until the natives get restless and start worrying about food running out." "Is that likely? Well, even though there are two decent supermarkets in the town, people start stockpiling. The last time we had anything like this, I was a young solicitor, just qualified, in fact. Bloody war zone in the town. The amount of assaults and breaches of the peace I dealt with in the weeks after was monumental. Still, I'm sure civility will have improved now we're in the 21st century." "Doon here? I'm no so sure," replied Scott. "Forever and ever. Amen," said the Reverend Ignatius Moore,
standing at one end of the long boardroom table in the ballroom of Cursivay House. A few echoed his amen, but most simply sighed and got stuck into their breakfast, glad the minister had finished.
"Well done, Reverend," said Bruce, smiling up at him. "I apologize for the lack of respect from some around this table. We really appreciate you taking the time to be with us this morning."
"That's all right," replied Moore. "I wonder, any chance of me and you having a quick chat once you've eaten? In private, if that's okay."
"Sure. Needing some funds for the church roof again?"
"And now?" replied Moore, leaning his head closer to Shannon's.
"Mr. Casely sent me. I'll meet you on the terrace in about half an hour."
Bruce watched him walk away, admonishing himself after a few seconds to try and not look so shocked. Campbell pulled an extending ladder from the loft hatch and climbed up it, somewhat unsteadily.
"If I'd known I was going to be as active this morning, I'd have consumed rather less of the amber nectar last night. We have the Shannon papers in a stout old trunk. Shouldn't be too hard to find."
Scott looked around Campbell's office. Stacks of leather-bound books sat in a huge case behind his long oaken desk. All was polished wood, green leather, and dark panelling. A laptop on Campbell's desk looked out of place in a space that Torquil Drysdale of 100 years ago might well have found familiar.
"Ah, here we are," called Campbell from the loft. "It's a bit awkward. Can you help me down this bloody ladder?"
Scott heard something being pushed across the floor above his head. Then Campbell appeared, a wooden casket at his feet. After much straining and no little profanity, the two men managed to manoeuvre the box down the ladder and onto the floor of Campbell's office. Scott studied it, noting the brass strips that bound the casket together, and the stout lock just under the lid.
"Hope you've got the key, Mr. Campbell." "Oh, nothing as secure as that in this place, Sergeant. We guard our tea money more closely than our old records. That was one of the reasons we were anxious to hand the damn thing over to the museum, but hey-ho."
He pulled open the lid of the box to reveal old files, many tied together with red ribbon. The smell of must and age filled the room.
"Now, let me see. Old Drysdale was a conscientious bugger, by all accounts. Not all of this is relevant to the Cursivay House debacle, but most of it is."
He peered through his half-glasses at a couple of old papers, blowing dust off them as he went.
"Now, here we are," he said, handing a thick file to Scott.
"You, Reverend Moore, I can hardly believe it," spluttered Bruce, standing on the frozen terrace of Cursivay House.
"I have my reasons, Bruce, as no doubt you do yourself," replied Moore, with a steely look in his eyes that disconcerted Shannon.
"Yes, well, you've seen how my cousin behaves. The hour my uncle expires, we'll be marginalized within this company, and who knows where it will all lead."
"And you don't want to have to go cap in hand to Maxie for your annual dividend, am I right?"
"Listen," he said, in a more relaxed manner,
"there's nothing to worry about. There's been a few little stumbles along the way, but everything will be fine."
"And what about Casely?"
I only know what I've heard. He was off message somehow. Too keen on other business, if you know what I mean."
"Women. That doesn't surprise me," said Shannon, remembering their last meeting in the bar at Notting Hill Gate, and the girl with the nice arse.
"I'm here as a safety valve, that's all," said Moore.
His Australian twang sounded suddenly more pronounced, thought Bruce.
"So you've been here all this time, just waiting for this moment?"
"Nah, not as simple as that, Bruce. As I say, I have my reasons, but nothing you have to worry about."
"Please tell me that these awful murders have nothing to do with our plan."
"They don't. We're as surprised as you. It seems your family has its fair share of enemies. But all that's not important. We go ahead today as planned. All you have to do is stick to what we agreed."
"So nothing changes. What about Maxwell?"
"Just you play your part, Bruce. Leave Maxwell to us. Now, if you will excuse me, I have to get back to my wife. She's been... well, she's not herself."
Moore left Bruce alone on the terrace, staring down at the long stretch of beach on which his brother had disappeared 50 years before. He couldn't work out whether his shivers were down to the extreme cold or the pounding of his heart. Scott was looking at a clipping from the Kinloch Herald, careful not to tear the fragile old paper. "The Mansion on the Hill Nearly Complete," read the headline. It carried on in smaller typeface. "The people of Blan set to celebrate with the Shannon family." Campbell handed him another newspaper. It described the forcible removal of Nathaniel Stewart and his family from the land upon which Kersevay House was constructed. Scott read on with great interest. "On Thursday last, at Kinloch Sheriff Court, a warrant was issued for the removal of Mr. Nathaniel Sinclair Stewart and his family from the land on Kersevay Point, Blan. Sheriff McGowan, assisted by his officers and 10 constables from Kinloch, travelled to Mr. Stewart's steading to effect the order. Unfortunately, they encountered much resistance by Mr. Stewart and his extended family, numbering some 30 souls, intent on preventing the warrant from being lawfully executed. Following what can only be described as the most extreme criminal behaviour, and the arrival of a detachment of a company of Argyll and Sutherland Highlanders, peace was eventually restored, and the rule of law enforced. Mr. Stewart and 10 others were placed under arrest for varying offences, including affray, assault on an officer of the court, and numerous breaches of the peace and obstruction of constables of the law, as well as wanton utterances of extreme blasphemy and profanity in front of a representative of the Crown. Mr. Nathaniel Stewart will appear in Kinloch on Wednesday next, in front of Sheriff A.P. McGowan, to answer these charges. In the opinion of this newspaper, the breakdown of the rule of law is a most serious turn of events. It is to be hoped that Mr. Stewart's punishment will be commensurate with the heinous crimes committed."
"Sounds as though the local rag decided who was in the wrong here, eh?" said Scott, handing the paper back to Campbell. "Not really surprising, given that Archibald Shannon was its proprietor at the time. In fact, the family only sold the paper in the 70s.
Campbell rummaged some more.
"Here's something you may be interested in. It's a transcript from Nathaniel Stewart's court appearance. As I recall, he was sent to Inverera jail for a period of 2 years' hard labour." "Bugger me, that's kind of steep, is it no? One can only guess at this distance of time, but I think it would be fair to say that Mr. Shannon had more than a little influence over Sheriff McGowan. They couldn't banish Stewart from the area, so it suited them fine to have him turning the wheel up in Inverera while the house was being built, just in case he decided to organise another riot." "Turning the wheel? Sounds innocuous, but in reality it broke many a stout heart. The prisoner was forced to turn a crank on a purpose-built machine for hours on end. The prison guard could change the degree of difficulty by means of a gearing system. Restrained brutality, breaking both body and spirit. As far as I'm aware, they subjected Stewart to it relentlessly. But in the end he prevailed, unbowed. Mark of the man, I'd say."
Scott studied the article, which took up 2 full pages of the old newspaper, now brown and fragile with age.
"What's this bit here?"
he asked, pointing to a passage in the middle of the article, underlined in faded blue ink.
"The famous curse, Sergeant. Highlighted by Drysdale, I assume. By all accounts it haunted him for what was left of his life. Turned from an agnostic into a pillar of the church, no less. And then he was found with his throat cut at the Rat Stone." "Yes, Jim mentioned that. Is this where he has them doon for disaster every 50 years? I know all about that." "A bit more comprehensive, Sergeant Scott. Here, I'll read it."
Campbell pushed his glasses higher up his nose and cleared his throat.
"When asked if he had anything to say in reply to the sentence, Nathaniel Stewart replied thus: 'I curse all you Shannons from now until the end of time. May calamity descend upon you this year and every 50 years in the future, as long as you hold our lands at Kersevay.' I have heard all that. What's the rest of it? 'At the end of days, there will be no eyes to see, no mouth to speak, no chest for breath, and no finger to point. The many will follow the one, consumed by flames after the fall,
and death will descend upon you and all who help and aid you in a deserved hell of fire and destruction, till you and all that come after you shall be left with nothing, not even life itself, and our family be returned to our home."
Campbell looked at Scott with a smile. "Poetic, really, wouldn't you agree? He was no duffer, old Stuart, when it came to curses, I must say. Of course, after the boy disappeared 50 years ago, the whole thing was resurrected. But people only remember the curse about the 50 years upon 50. The rest is always forgotten."
"And what about this Stuart? How did he survive? Seems that he left Blan with very little."
"Indeed. Though if the stories are true, with his hereditary position as Arch-Druid, or whatever he was called, he could always rely on help, wherever those traditions prevailed."
"What? He was a Druid? Surely they don't believe in all that stuff anywhere else."
"Yes, it's very popular in North America to this day, so I'm led to believe. Old myths and traditions have real power through generations of families separated from the old country, as they would have it. Just look at all the bloody clan gatherings and pipe bands they have across there."
"Aye, but this mumbo-jumbo. Come on, big man."
"Not as though any of you police officers are involved in any secret societies, eh?"
"Aye, well, that's a different thing altogether," said Scott, clearing his throat and looking uncomfortable.
"Yes, I dare say," Campbell smiled. "But don't be carried away with the notion that Nathaniel Stuart was cast to the four winds penniless and hopeless when he left Blan. He may well have stumbled upon better times elsewhere. It's almost a certainty, I would say."
Scott thought for a moment, a frown spreading across his face.
"I'll need to make a call, Mr. Campbell.